We all need care at some point in our lives, when we're young, when we're ill, and when we grow older. And caring calls for many of the qualities at the very core of what it is to be human: empathy, compassion, selflessness, and commitment. We're in a pandemic and we've been clapping for carers, yet care is so often undervalued, skimped on, commoditized, or ignored. The need for care is growing fast, and many feel that we now have a crisis in care. Why is that? And what can be done about it? Here to discuss this today, I'm thrilled to welcome Madeleine Bunting, who is a prize-winning author, a broadcaster, and as many of you will know, a journalist, formerly of The Guardian. Last year, she authored a really thoughtful book on the subject of care called Labours of Love, The Crisis of Care.
Every part of the care labour force is desperately underpaid, chronically underpaid, because of this fundamental cultural distortion in which we don't recognise a form of emotional labour that can be enormously demanding.
Anne-Marie Rafferty is Professor of Nursing Policy at King's College London, and currently she's President of the Royal College of Nursing. Anne-Marie has written widely, but a common theme has been care and its meaning, as well as the role of nursing in healthcare.
We have got to invest in the care sector as never before, and I think we need a massive fiscal stimulus to actually do that, an accelerator, putting it on steroids.
I thought I'd just kick off with a question for you, Madeleine. Your book was written just before the pandemic hit. Has the pandemic changed your view that there is a crisis in care?
Well, definitely. I think that what happened in March, my book was just going to the printers, and we sort of, you know, hold the presses sort of thing, so that I could write an author's note at the beginning, because never in my wildest imaginings did I think that the nation would stand on its doorstep to clap for carers. In those first sort of tumultuous few weeks of the pandemic, there was the most astonishing inversion of our understanding of value, of labour, of work, whose work really matters. It was a paradigm shift. Now, I'm not saying that's going to lead to dramatic political change, because I think those two are not necessarily sort of tied together. There can be a disconnect there. But what I think everybody was suddenly brought really up short against was that there was very little they could do about this pandemic. And the people who were doing everything they possibly could, the nurses and the doctors in the desperately overworked hospitals, our lives were in their hands. And our gratitude, there's been many comments made in the months since about that, clapping for our carers. But in our street, you know, you could hear the fireworks and the drums and the trumpets. I remember watching a pedestrian walking down our street as we were clapping, and their jaw was just dropping as they filmed it. Now, I think that has a massive impact, and I would hope that we can find the political will to actually follow through on that.
And Anne-Marie, do you think that that clapping will change our attitudes to care? Or do you think that it was a temporary thing and people will forget and everything will snap back to how it was?
It would be wonderful to think about the clap for carers as having that continuity. But I get the impression that that initial outpouring of emotion, and I certainly felt it myself, was something which has not really been consistently retained. I feel that the energy is eking out of the system, and it's not, certainly not at the pitch that it was. And the snapback that you referred to, Jennifer, I mean, we can think about the pandemic, and it's often been compared to a war zone. The fact is that there were many aspects of wartime policies that did snap back, and certainly after the First World War, women's participation in the labour force, things did return to a kind of pre-war norm. So I think the challenge here is how to build a sustained form of political pressure to ensure that the snapback simply doesn't happen.
I suppose there is a question, isn't there, about whether people were clapping for care or whether they were clapping for something else, a sort of security. But I just wanted to move on to what we really mean by care. It's a small word, but it has multiple meanings, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a bit of a sort of treasure trove, really. It's a short word. And yet, actually, when you begin to sort of unpack it, both its sort of etymology, its history, but also the ways in which we use it, you know, it's multifaceted. Just to dip back briefly into that previous conversation about what the significance of standing on our doorsteps and clapping was, I would say that the key sort of standout from that was the point of solidarity. And I think solidarity is actually essential both to motivate care and actually to sort of inspire the practice of care. That sense of common shared humanity, which, as you said in your introduction, Jennifer, you know, we all share one characteristic very, very clearly, which is the fact of our vulnerability at different points in the life course when we need and utterly depend on the care of others. And it's a circular thing. And that's the funny thing about care. We are both receivers and we are givers. And that circularity whereby we learn to care by being cared for. And that continues throughout our lives, that we experience care and in turn, we then offer it on. And, you know, I spent 5 years asking a very simple question of dozens and dozens of people, including Anne-Marie, who was a terrific interviewee. And I said, you know, what do we mean by care? What is it? What is it when you do it? And at the end of 5 years, I felt there were three words that really run through it a bit like lettering through rock, because there's 100 different ways to care. But I think there's three consistent characteristics, and that is presence, attention, and touch. So that's my starting point, Jennifer.
Thank you. And maybe Anne-Marie, could you take that further and just give us a view about particularly nursing and those three characteristics, presence, attention and touch? Because obviously nursing is a job, but also it requires a certain sort of solidarity of the type that Madeleine mentions.
I think for nursing, it's also not just a question of some of those characteristics to do with, you know, presence and attention. It's a science. There's a science underpinning how that all happens. But I guess the empire, one might say, of empathy in which care is embedded itself does help us to kind of stretch our faculties into the space where care actually happens. And nurses, of course, have been seen to embody those kind of virtues and, you know, as historians, we've noted the virtue script within which nursing has been birthed and born. And then I think tried to reject and repudiate it, because I think we don't just want to be seen as sentimental creatures, you know, empty vessels into which emotion is poured in the caring process.
I think that brings me nicely onto what you began to touch on, Anne-Marie, which is about our attitude to caring and how we have viewed care over time. And Madeleine, in your book, you spend quite a lot of time on this. And I wondered if you could just outline this, how you think our attitude has changed.
I'm not sure our attitude has changed, actually, Jennifer. Oh. I think the question you're asking is, you know, what is the history of care?
Yes.
So perhaps I'll tackle it that way round, because actually one of the arguments in my book is the sort of persistence of various forms of mythology, which are now really problematic. So to just loop back a moment, what I'm going to try and do is put care into a historical context. And that means really looking at the way in which from the 18th century onwards, the great sort of traditions of Western thought and philosophy and economics completely ignored the labour of care and this essential processes by which human life is sustained. The care within a household, which ensures the reproduction of children, the caring of the elderly, and those great sort of 18th century economists and philosophers such as Adam Smith, you know, there's a wonderfully witty book title by a Swedish journalist called Who Cooked Adam Smith's Dinner? Because, of course, we never get to know, you know, he's poring over his manuscripts in his study. Yeah. But actually, the only reason why he was able to do that was because his mother was cooking him supper every night. So that sort of illustrates this sort of invisibility of care. It's been taken for granted. And along with that came the idea that care was just women's work. It was feminized and therefore dismissed. It was not of significance. What was significant was men's role in the public sphere. We then get the incredible trap that nursing has been in, that nurses are saints and angels, and they do it out of the goodness of their heart. And they don't really need to be paid properly because they're doing it because they're so virtuous. You know, it was part of the genius of Florence Nightingale to devise a way of educated women having an independent working life outside the home. You know, an astonishing, revolutionary thing she managed to do. But she did it by trapping women in this virtue script, as Anne-Marie describes. You know, they could never sort of assert themselves. They could never challenge the doctors. They could never certainly ask for appreciation or, you know, a pay rise. And so every part of the care labour force is desperately underpaid, chronically underpaid. And there are parts that are worse than nursing. You know, childcare sector is appalling because of this fundamental cultural distortion in which we don't recognise what I would describe really, you know, in part as a form of emotional labour that can be enormously demanding.
Yes, to pursue that, Anne-Marie, in your biography, you say that your mother was a nurse and you were strongly influenced by her career. Thinking about how she viewed care, how would you think that has influenced you and changed today?
You know, when my mum did nursing, the career choice was going to nursing for her anyway, coming from, you know, a very small mining village in Fife with very few prospects because she had to leave school at 13. And in fact, was really going to work in a factory or a shop or nursing. I mean, that's where it was pegged in terms of its status. So she chose nursing because she would get some top-up education. You know, I think we perhaps are in danger of over-sentimentalising motivation. Sometimes it's very pragmatic in terms of why people make these choices. The emphasis that Madeleine draws out on labour process and the fiendish hard work that goes into caring, I think nowhere is that more evident than in those early days. My mum trained in the 30s, did 7 years of training, Fevers General Midwifery. And, you know, they were scrubbing, you were doing a lot of domestic work, but you were doing the work of probably two or three people. So it was a really, really tough physical, and the psychological regime itself was pretty tough going. You know, I think the environment of care was one of regimen and of routine and of complying with rules and punishments and sanctions. Even sitting, talking to patients was considered a negative. It took you away from the work. It was a hard, emotional environment.
Madeleine, I wondered if you could talk a little bit about that, where some of the biggest challenges are for care, particularly on time, the demand for care, the supply for care, the shortages and so on.
Well, there is so much to say about this. One of the things I would say is about ratios, which has, of course, been the subject of some of Anne-Marie's research. How much time a nurse has on a ward is about how many staff there are. How much time a nursery worker has for each individual child is about ratios. How many kids is she responsible for? The social care worker or the domiciliary care worker who's rushing in 15-minute appointments, which is a scandal, into someone elderly at home to help feed and wash and dress. You know, that appalling measure of time, which, you know, has caused great outrage. Everybody knows it's shocking. But in the end, that is about how much we're prepared to pay for care. It's all about budgeting. So it's back to this question about, as a relatively rich society, how much do we value care and are we prepared to pay for it? And that's, you know, to loop back briefly to the starting point of our conversation around the impact of the pandemic, which is that we're going to emerge from this pandemic with a shattered economy, really desperately high levels of debt. And we will feel that deterioration in the country's economy very clearly in the years that lie ahead. And the battle for resources and state resources is going to be really fierce. So the paradox about the pandemic is it's made us aware of care and the value of care, but actually is going to leave us with fewer resources than for several generations to really invest in the kinds of care that we're going to need. And that's why I find this particular historical moment, one of the many reasons why I find it so incredibly painful, is that as an aging population, the demand and need for care is increasing significantly long before the pandemic hit. And we all know the figures. We all know this, you know. But the point is, we seem to be peculiarly incapable at a kind of collective level to meet that challenge about, you know, what is it? The Lancet projects a doubling in the over 85s requiring 24-hour care by 2035. That's 14 years away. That's not even that far away.
If policymakers have tin ears when it comes to the value of care, how do we demonstrate better the arguments for better care and not cutting back? Anne-Marie, I know you've spent quite a lot of time thinking about the nursing shortage and the impact. Is there some more work we could do there to demonstrate? Often it's sort of quantitative, isn't it? Facts and figures rather than the moral arguments of the value of care that somehow hold sway in these discussions.
Yeah, well, I would challenge, actually, Jennifer, that proposition that policymakers have a tin ear. I think we are reaching politicians in a way in which perhaps we've not really been able to before. And you're right about the qualitative angle on this. Storytelling is the most powerful tool that we have. And we've been convening meetings in my RCN role up and down the regions with MPs, politicians and decision makers. And they literally are all ears and so moved by the stories that nurses are telling them about what it's like actually nursing patients, not just on wards, but in communities. I think maybe there's, you know, could be toxically optimistic, but I do think the tide might be turning a bit. But if I can also return, Jennifer, to the point about, you know, the economy. And what do we do when we're debt-ridden and we have a shattered economy? Then what about, you know, a Keynesian care economy? What about actually using our health needs for growth in jobs, growth in the economy through jobs? Yeah. The RCN's just done a piece of work on the pay deal. We're asking for 12.5%. You know, that seems like a big jump, but actually not in the context of having lost something similar to that over the last 10 years through various austerity measures. When you actually look at what pay rises do in terms of reinvestment back into the economy, creating jobs, consumer spending in local economies, you know, it comes out at a fraction of 12.5%. So my part of my perhaps Pollyanna solution to moving forward post-pandemic is a Keynesian care economy. We have got to invest in the care sector as never before. And I think we need a massive fiscal stimulus to actually do that and find ways of growing the care sector. It's already been marked out as one of the big growth areas. But I mean, giving it an accelerator, putting it on steroids.
Yes, that is certainly discussed, isn't it, as a possible solution. In fact, every country in the world needs more carers, as it seems. The other great hope seems to be technology. And I notice, Madeline, in your book, you are worried about technology playing too big a role in the area of care. And in fact, you said in another sentence, bureaucracy, marketization and technology is a toxic combination. Do you think technology really does have a bigger place? Or do you think actually what Anne-Marie is saying, that actually we really must take a more Keynesian approach to employing more carers is the way forward?
So it implied in your question there, Jennifer, is it's a sort of either or. Yeah. It's kind of either more people to be employed or it's technology. And I think that's a kind of false dichotomy. I think there are contexts in which forms of robotic care, and I'm not talking about some sort of anthropomorphic kind of robot Dalek sort of looking after you. But, you know, I definitely can imagine, you know, that it may be that when I reach frailty in my 80s, that to have various aides in the house that help me make a cup of tea might be quite handy. And the way in which designers are thinking about how to create environments which assist in that way can be very, very interesting and exciting. So I am not kind of 100% against all forms of technology. That would be absolutely daft. You know, I'm very, very grateful for all kinds of technological breakthroughs that have been absolutely spectacular in terms of medical achievements. I think it's really dangerous to get kind of really to not recognize the both aspect of this. So one of the problems about some sort of planners and policy making in healthcare, and Lord Darzi is a classic example of this, is to get so swept away by the technology and think that this is the perfect answer to everything. And equally, it's crazy to say it's a disaster. You quoted a phrase that I used, and I use it in a, you know, the phrase is quite specific. I'm saying the combination of bureaucratization and technology and commercialization is a toxic brew. It's when you put them all three together. Independently, of course you need some bureaucracy in a health service. Of course you need technology. And there may be points where you need some commercial activity. I'm not ruling out all of that. It's when they come together without a proper understanding of the role of relationship in all healing, in all processes of the body and health, that there is a dimension of relationship, and that cannot be fully replaced by any form of technology. So, you know, when people say, actually, you know, there's forms of AI that can diagnose faster and more accurately than a doctor. Well, that's possible, to which my reply is that, OK, so the doctor may be able to draw on those diagnostic programs to help her or him. But the diagnostic programs can't do all the other parts of a doctor's job, which is so much to do with observation and understanding where the patient is at, and you know, in terms of their sort of acceptance and knowledge of a complex program of medication, et cetera, et cetera. So to go back to Anne-Marie's point, 100% with Anne-Marie, I don't even think we should call this Pollyanna. Economists have looked at a Keynesian type approach to the care economy, and they have concluded, they did a really interesting study in 2015, that if you need to stimulate an economy, like after a crisis, the conventional model is through infrastructure. Build lots of roads, build lots of bridges, you know, get money into the economy. In fact, if you decide, let's get the money into the economy through the pay packets of carers, of hundreds of thousands of a largely female workforce, you are going to distribute the benefits of that much more evenly in terms of geography and regions, and you're going to get it right into the heart of families, where we know that the effects of poverty on children are so disastrous. So, in fact, you know, what Anne-Marie is suggesting in terms of a major, major investment in the care economy could be the best way out of this pandemic, because we know that, you know, the impact on children has been devastating. So it's going to be urgent that we address their plight in the years ahead. So the care economy ends up kind of hitting all sorts of targets, you know, dead on. And so I'm a very enthusiastic supporter of exactly that. And, you know, being able to argue for it in a way that is, you know, this is not about some wishy-washy, wouldn't it be nice? Actually, this makes really clear economic sense.
We know that social care has been such a threadbare service. This has been in plain sight for so long. And yet still, successive governments, as we well know, have ducked it. How on earth can this be amplified enough to get them over the line in something so basic as social care, let alone, you know, early years care or anything else? What is really going to make the difference this time?
You know, health and care and whether we combine them somehow. We used to have a Department of Health and Social Services, and bringing everything together, separating it. I mean, these schisms are political conveniences at some point. But getting back to Madeleine's point around, you know, what are we actually prepared as a society to pay for care is probably, you know, the bottom line. And at what level are we prepared to do that through general taxation and other sources of finance, some of it private, you know, maybe through pensions, I don't know. But I think there's got to be an honest and grown-up debate about the likely cost of getting both sectors, health and care, brought together. And that is happening in integrated care systems. And Jennifer, you've written very eloquently about this. But I think there's a tremendous amount of goodwill out there to draw these together and, you know, have that kind of big bang. It's interesting, I think, the point that Madeleine makes in the book about who actually makes the decisions on care and policymakers themselves. And, you know, you think about it, most people are not moribund and ill themselves. Most people are relatively healthy. What if we inverted, we upended that and we said no care policy can be made of significant proportion? I'm just busking this on my, you know, by the seat of the pants here. But actually it's got to contain people who are going to be the end users and the beneficiaries. What if we were to really ramp that up and say, what kind of design of service do you actually want? And then it's up to politicians to actually find the solutions as to how to enable and deliver on that. So I think there's probably a radical reimagining of how we do policy in that space to help guide us through this huge moment of opportunity, because a crisis brings opportunity as well as pain and the mega downside, of course.
Madeleine?
Well, again, I suppose I think it's both. You know, I think we need a sort of a national championing. You know, it was interesting to see Boris Johnson's tone after he came out of hospital and the way in which he talked about the medical staff. I mean, I found that moment where he listed the names of all the nurses that had looked after him, you know, that was a real moment of hope, because I thought he's actually had a personal experience of something that could be really, really sort of lasting and significant. Now, we're yet to see whether that translates. But imagine if he launched a care economy, you know, and made all the sort of song and dance about it. And, it was a big thing. I think it goes against the grain of a still very male dominated political establishment. There's plenty of them that have very little insight into what care really entails. And they're not going to get that insight, as Anne-Marie points out, until they're in their 80s when they, you know, the penny will drop and then it's too late because they're no longer got the power. But so I think that a sort of big national change of the kind of language I'm very, very interested in language. I don't like the language of delivering care. You know, that's what you do with packages. You don't deliver. You know, somebody comes to my doorstep and hands a package over, I don't see them again. That is not care. So, you know, can we change that language? And then to go to your other point about local people and, you know, kind of, I think there's a hugely important task about that sort of redesign. So one of the very interesting conversations I've had since the book came out is with the organisation Shared Lives, which is a terrific organisation, which is about reinventing social care, and very, very inspiring, and kind of bringing almost like a foster model to people who, for one reason or another, can't live on their own. And building relationships between people who agree to quote unquote foster somebody. And, you know, they've got to scale now. There's about 14,000 people in their program. And there's been some work with Manchester about how that will become the dominant role, the model of social care across Greater Manchester. And it's just those kinds of organisations which are really taking the kind of relationship aspect of care, that they're not leaving that as a kind of last thing to think about. They're actually putting it right in the centre alongside expertise and skill and training. So, you know, it's a bit of both. I would love it if a kind of national commission was set up, which was all about, you know, the care economy. But just to pick the point up that Anne-Marie made, which is that the politicians are listening. I was on Start the Week with Jeremy Hunt. It was really remarkable. He's not the most favoured person in health circles, I know, for his, you know, various decisions he made as health secretary. But I think he's really made a journey. You know, he was really, really interesting. It was terrific.
Yes, and actually he was on our first guest on our first podcast, actually, and was very thoughtful, I think, in many respects. What a good place to end the discussion. These are huge issues and we'll clearly be looking at them again later this year. Meantime, I'd like to thank Madeleine Bunting and Anne-Marie Rafferty for their analysis and suggesting some really useful ways forward. I'd strongly encourage you to read Madeleine's really thoughtful book, Labours of Love, The Crisis of Care. And as always, you'll find other material we've mentioned in this episode and more in the show notes. And we'd also love it if you could give us a friendly review. Next month, we'll be crossing the pond to ask the question, what will President Biden do next about reforming healthcare in the US? And what does this mean for the UK? Join me then, and thanks for listening.